everybody, and welcome to another episode of All Crime, No Cattle. And if you're paying attention, this is episode 50, or 50th episode. Woo-hoo! I'm very excited.
The Big 5-0.
I'm Aaron.
And I'm Shay. And today, we're bringing you the much-anticipated part two of The Tale of Two Tocayos. So, quick correction corner real fast. Last episode, I was pronouncing Tocayos wrong. I was saying Tocoyos. It is Tocayos. It was pointed out to me, and I apologize for my inadequate Spanish.
He did look it up on the internet.
I did.
And the internet did you dirty.
It did. One of the pronunciation guides didn't have the correct pronunciation, and apparently Tocoyo is almost like a gordita, and it's food-related in Spanish, so...
Which is only fitting for us.
Yeah. But anyways, I digress. Let's get into our episode today, Aaron. What do you think?
I'm ready.
Well, last week we outlined a heinous crime that appeared to be resolved, the bloody attack and murder of Wanda Lopez. Ultimately, a man was arrested, charged, and sentenced to death for her murder. His name was Carlos de Luna. Eyewitness testimony and de Luna's previous sexual assault charges were key components in deciding that Carlos was a danger to society. However, as we mentioned at the end of last episode, there is one small problem. Texas may have sent the wrong man to the death chamber in 1989. So get ready for some answers, some more questions, and some shocking revelations as we bring you the conclusion to our two-part series. So sources for today are just like they were last time. We're going to use the Austin Chronicle, The Guardian, The Chicago Tribune, also some TV interviews that were done with ABC News, PBS NewsHour, and I also threw in another set of interviews done on Al Jazeera back in 2012. And our main primary source is going to be none other than Professor James Liebman's book, The Wrong Carlos, written back in 2014. So before we get too far in this episode, I wanted to read a quote that James Liebman included in his book. And this is from Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia back in 2006, when he was speaking about wrongful convictions specifically related to the death penalty. And he said that there has never been, quote, a single case, not one, in which it was clear that a person was executed for a crime he did not commit. If such an event had occurred in recent years, we would not have to hunt for it. The innocent's name would be shouted from the rooftops. So I think we're going to have to get our shouting voices ready, Aaron, because we're going to be using them by the end of this episode. So at the very end of last episode, I dropped a bombshell that another Carlos actually existed. His name was Carlos Hernandez. He appeared to be a strong suspect and possibly could have been the actual murderer. He also happened to look very similar to Carlos de Luna. First, let's spend some time going over what we know about this other Carlos and see if any red flags pop up along the way. Do you remember that we talked a bit about the casino club?
Yeah, so the bolo that went out said the suspect might perhaps have been looking for a ride to the casino club.
And also remember that de Luna had a previous conviction there for drunken disorderly conduct, and that was a known hangout for Carlos de Luna, our first suspect. Guess who else was a known regular at the casino club back during the 1980s? None other than Carlos Hernandez. James Liebman and his team of investigators interviewed several people for his book, The Wrong Carlos. One of those individuals was a girlfriend of Carlos Hernandez and also a frequent patron of the casino club, and that was Mary Margaret Topaya, aka Maggie. Maggie talked to Liebman's team and painted a picture of the club during the 1980s that sounded a lot like Patrick Swayze's Roadhouse. The club was a rough spot to party for sure. There was lots of stabbings, shootings, underage drinking, but also it was a hot spot to meet up if you wanted to find some drugs or perhaps some casual sex. Maggie knew Carlos de Luna. He liked to party at the casino club, but he was pretty much a drunk and a ladies' man. He dressed fancy and he hit on girls until he got too drunk and eventually tossed out by the bouncers. She also knew Carlos Hernandez. He grew up on the south side of Corpus Christi and had carved out a little niche for himself as a petty thug, drug dealer, and opportunistic criminal. In fact, Maggie had a crush on Hernandez. She thought he was handsome and liked that he had this tough boy mystique. The two ended up dating in 1978. Later, Maggie found out that Hernandez always had a sweet side with women. But only in the beginning. Maggie was pregnant from a previous relationship when she met Carlos, but Hernandez liked that about her. He seemed to insist on taking care of her and her unborn child. He pampered her, bought her food, and even helped take care of the baby once it was born. Maggie said, quote, Carlos knew Eric wasn't his, but for some odd reason, he acted like he was. Things seemed good at first between Maggie and Hernandez, until he began to change. He started to drop his sweetheart facade and showed flashes of his hot temper, violence, and eventually became possessive over Maggie and her child. According to her interviews in The Wrong Carlos, Maggie said that Hernandez could change at the flick of a switch. Quote, Carlos had a mean side, a very mean side. He would change from one day to the next. He would be okay, you know, for a couple of days, and then the next day he would be all mad. End quote. After Eric was born, Maggie decided to dress up and wait out on the porch for Hernandez to come home one day. But when he did, he was surprisingly angry that Maggie had put on a dress and sat out on their porch for all the neighbors to see. He yelled at her, and then he took her inside. He beat her severely, and he finally raped her. Maggie said Hernandez's strange split personality wasn't the only thing about him that really worried her. Hernandez had regular violent nightmares almost weekly. Sometimes dreams like these that Maggie describes are referred to as, quote, night terrors. I used to have these a lot when I was a little kid. It's strange when you have them at such regularity when you are a grown-up, though. Maggie would wake up to Carlos swinging wildly into the air while he was screaming or crying. Not only that, but sometimes he would be so consumed by his night terrors that he would attempt to strangle Maggie or attack her as she tried to wake him up. Although she tried to console Carlos, he never did want to talk about his horrible dreams. Quote, they just angered him. I always felt like they drove him to do the things he did, the bad stuff. End quote. The other real strange thing about Carlos Hernandez was the fact that the man was fascinated with his locking buck knife. He carried it everywhere he went. Maggie said that late at night, Hernandez would spend a long time sharpening his blade with a whetstone. He liked to threaten people with it. She even caught him talking to the knife on a few occasions and witnessed him, quote, tucking the knife under his pillow like he was putting a child to bed. Hernandez had several of these knives over the years, but they all ended up being very similar. A fake gold casing, most likely brass, a brown faux wood handle, and a big, thick, sharp locking blade. Hernandez was also very good at using his knife. He would impress his nephews as he threw it into trees, or how fast he could quick draw it out of his right-hand pocket, while in the same motion, flicking the ever-sharp blade out for all to see. Eventually, Maggie discovered that Hernandez had several other women on the side and began questioning their relationship. Later, she stated that Hernandez's dark side began to take hold of him, and she started to worry about herself and her newborn baby, Eric. A few months later, she moved out of the house with Hernandez with the help of some friends and family. One of those people was her brother-in-law, Richard Garcia. Richard later spoke with investigators and the Liebman team about Hernandez and said, quote, Carlos was a coward who beat women to do what he wanted. He liked to make them his slaves. If he needed to fight a man, he would get someone to do it for him. End quote. Garcia summed up Hernandez as a man that was, quote, willing to fight women to get them to do what he wanted, but would back down against other men, end quote. Just so you know, Carlos Hernandez wasn't a large or muscular man. He was about 5'7" and 160 pounds. But many family, friends, and locals remembered Hernandez for his terrifying demeanor. A close friend of the Hernandez family, Freddie Schilling, told private investigators that, quote, Carlos was very violent. He threatened my family many, many times. He would pull clubs or that awful knife. I fought him off for a long time, but I thought eventually one of us was going to get hurt, and probably really bad. End quote. Freddie also mentioned that Hernandez had a violent reputation around town. Hernandez once showed up to Freddie's home to visit his sister covered in blood after he, quote, ended a dispute between himself and his brother by stabbing him in the leg over at a bar. End quote. Hernandez was at his worst once he had a bit of alcohol in his system. One of Hernandez's girlfriends from 1985 described him as a, quote, real demon to live with when he was under the influence. Sober, he seemed quite the opposite. He was loving, caring, and patient. But when he went out clubbing or drinking, though, quote, he became an evil person. Later, this became a regular thing. So I think that kind of gives you an idea of the kind of person that we're dealing with so far. The Liebman team didn't have any trouble finding someone to talk to about Carlos Hernandez when they went down there. You could basically throw a rock in any direction and find someone in town who knew him and had a bad experience with him or had been threatened by him at some point.
Yeah, so he's an angry person, especially when he gets drunk, and he seems to really enjoy taking his anger out on women, especially.
Yes, and he loves to carry that locking buck knife.
And we know that he is prone to sexual violence as well.
Very much so.
Which we haven't really broached that issue with Wanda, but I think that that's a really good question as to whoever attacked her, why did they attack her? Where were they trying to drag her to within the store? What were their main motivations for being there?
And there was an assumption on the investigator's part that this was a robbery. But as we're going to find out, that may not be the whole story.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
So yeah, inside Liebman's book, you can find a lot more of these types of stories. They interviewed, like I said, a ton of people, a lot of Hernandez's ex-girlfriends, and there's some really, really horrific, but also interesting things in that book. And I would highly recommend checking some of that out if you want to learn more about Hernandez during the late 70s and late 80s. I think when you start looking at this case, it's easy to overlook a lot of Carlos Hernandez's life and criminal record because over a 40 plus year period, it was just checkered with instances like these where he got off with extremely light sentences for assault or drunken disorderly conduct. Let's just highlight some of his previous charges real quick. In 1971, he was driving drunk at over 100 miles per hour when he killed his sister's fiance when he wrecked the car. He served no time for this offense and was just let out on good behavior.
So he didn't even get a DUI for this?
No. He didn't get a manslaughter charge. He got nothing. In 1972, he received a 20-year sentence for a conviction of three separate gas station holdups in Corpus Christi. However, the parole board let him out just 5 years later.
Do we know details about these gas station holdups?
Yes. They were at knife point and they were pretty much cash grabs.
Did anyone actually get injured?
No.
But he does like to frequent a gas station to do whatever he wants to do.
Yeah, and you know, he's not one of those like really thought out, organized criminals. He's an opportunist. So
yeah, he sounds really impulsive, especially, yeah, again, if he's in his cups.
Exactly. And then in 1979, Hernandez was arrested in connection for the murder of Dalia Sauceda. This case is really interesting because there are some parallels and similarities to the Wanda Lopez case. Even though Hernandez was the initial prime suspect in the Sauceda case, he was able to charm the lead prosecutor into pursuing another man as the killer, Jesse Garza. So here's a parallel in this case, very similar to how he allowed DeLuna to take the heat for a possible crime. Jesse Garza is pretty much having the same thing happen to him, except for it's even worse in this case because he's really pushing prosecutors to Jesse Garza and blaming it on him.
Is he claiming to be an eyewitness to this crime?
His basic story is that he was hanging out with this woman earlier in the night, had a few drinks in her van, and then left. He claimed he knew that Jesse Garza had a relationship with her and that he was probably the one that did it. Along with Hernandez's account of the events, another eyewitness also fingered Jesse Garza for the murder. Basically, what happened was this eyewitness saw Jesse with Sauceda earlier in the day, and he assumed that they were hanging out that night. So that put Jesse with Sauceda on the evening just a few hours before her eventual murder. So Sauceda's body was actually found in her custom van only a third of a mile from a club Hernandez liked to frequent. A few young boys unfortunately discovered the vehicle in some high weeds. When they opened the side sliding door, they found a naked woman covered in blood. Across from her, on the other side of some trash and some Schlitz beer cans, was a small child curled up on a seat nearby. She was still alive. The poor woman had been attacked, raped, and strangled to death inside of her own van in front of her daughter.
How old was the little girl?
Oh, she was just like a baby, like a couple years old, maybe, I think. Oh. Maybe like a year or two. The attacker also took the time to cut a large bloody X deep into the woman's back with a knife. And this went from her shoulder down to her buttocks. It was a big X. The lead detective on the case was none other than Olivia Escobedo. If that name rings a bell, it's because she was the lead detective on Wanda Lopez's crime scene investigation. Olivia Escobedo didn't do a very good job on this crime scene either, it looks like, because she neglected to look into fingerprints on beer cans, saliva evidence, hair and fiber evidence. It's not a good look. And all of this would come back to haunt the DA's office when the case went to trial.
Well, it seems like she has a really nice habit of not paying attention to evidence when it comes to murder scenes.
We'll get into more of that when we go back to Wanda's crime scene here in a little bit, but she made a name for herself in not properly going through a crime scene. In fact, none of the evidence in the van matched Jesse at all. There was no forensic evidence whatsoever in that van that could tie Jesse to the scene.
So what happened?
This whole case ends up going to trial based on eyewitness testimony alone. And Hernandez and the other witness both testify in the case against Jesse Garza. The only problem is that when Carlos got on the stand and explained how he had been drinking with Dalia Sauceda that day, on cross-examination, the other attorney tore his timeline apart. And he asked him some really tough questions, and he couldn't keep the events together. He couldn't keep his story straight. And it really made Carlos Hernandez look bad. At the end, the jury found Jesse Garza innocent of the murder. And interestingly enough, a lot of them mentioned that they actually thought Carlos did it.
Oh, wow. That is really interesting.
Yeah, some of them went up to Hector De Pena, the attorney that was defending Jesse Garza. They asked a lot of questions like, why wasn't Carlos looked at for this? Like, he seems like a good suspect. Well, later investigations showed that there was a stronger case to be made for Carlos Hernandez. Those beer cans, they actually had Carlos's fingerprints on them.
The beer cans found within the van that the body was found in.
Yes. They also found some fibers in the van that matched fibers from clothing that he was wearing that day. And they found some hair follicles that they did comparative analysis on that also matched him. In fact, nothing in the van tied Jesse Garza to the murder. It all pointed back to Carlos. Well, in 1986, this case would come back to haunt Hernandez. He was charged and sent to trial for the murder of Dalia Sauceda. There was a big problem with this case, though. There was a lot of damning evidence, and there was a lot of new forensic evidence that came out in this case. It all got misplaced before trial. Eventually, the charges against Carlos would all be dropped.
They just lost all of the evidence?
Yeah. There was some huge screw-up, and all the evidence was tainted.
And without the forensic evidence, they don't have anything on Carlos.
They had nothing.
Ugh. Wow.
Carlos Hernandez's girlfriend remembered something he told her near the time of this murder. We talked a little bit about his night terrors that he suffered from earlier in the episode. After another horrible night terror, Carlos reportedly explained his dream to his girlfriend. He told her he had done something horrible. He had murdered a woman in a van, carved an X in her back, let her child watch, and gotten away with it. His girlfriend thought this was merely part of Carlos's dream until she heard the details of the Sauceda case on the news.
Man. And was this information ever brought to detectives? Or was this after the charges were already dropped and she didn't even realize that she had information that might pertain to the case?
Yeah, this didn't come out until later in the late 80s. And this was after everything was dropped. But it's something to consider as we move forward.
Yeah, it's definitely damning evidence, it seems like, if it's true.
Yeah, and we're going to see a pattern with these omissions of guilt or, you know, him talking to people about things that have happened in cases he's related to or outright bragging. By 1989, though, Hernandez attacked yet another woman using a lock blade buck knife named Dina Ibanez. He viciously attacked her on her way into her home after work one night. He was jealous Dina was sleeping with another man and not him. He stabbed her in the stomach, pinned her against a tree, and told her that he planned to have his way with her. Next, he drug her into the house and raped her, but somehow Dina was able to survive the attack. She later called the police and filed charges. This time, Hernandez was convicted of a 10-year sentence, but somehow, once again, he was paroled after only serving a year and a half in prison.
How in God's name do you spend a year and a half in prison for almost murdering a woman, stabbing her, and raping her?
Yeah, I know. It's crazy. But again, we're deep in the late 80s, right? And this is when Texas was paroling everyone, left and right. Nobody served a long sentence for pretty much anything.
Yeah, it seems like we see these cases a whole lot of the time. And that's what's so problematic is when we have these offenses that are so violent in nature. What do you think these people are going to do? They're not getting rehabbed in prison.
No.
They're just going to turn around and continue being violent.
Especially someone who has a clear track record of violence against women with a knife.
Yeah.
And you know, the real tragic part in Dina Ibanez's case is that she had to live in the same town with Hernandez after he was paroled for years. And she constantly lived in fear that he was going to come and attack her again.
Of course. That would be terrifying. I mean, that's something that, what are you supposed to do in that situation as a victim of this man?
Yeah, you just end up constantly looking over your shoulder. And, you know, she worked late nights. She was often coming home in the dark. You know how terrifying that would be?
Yeah.
Well, finally, Carlos Hernandez's parole officers had had enough of his antics and sent him back to prison for good after he assaulted his neighbor with a 9-inch knife. They apparently got into some disagreement about their yards and money that was owed, and he decided to pull out a 9-inch knife and come after them. Hernandez went to prison and luckily was never paroled again. He ended up dying 3 years later due to cirrhosis of the liver in a prison up in Northeast Texas.
Oh, wow. And that's just the end of his story, huh?
Yep. And that was in 1999.
How long was the sentence he was serving at the time?
Well, I believe he was on parole for that original 10-year sentence. So he had to go back and continue serving on his 10-year sentence since he broke his parole. And I believe he had to go and serve the rest of his sentence on top of a knife assault charge.
Okay. Wow, that's crazy that he is just dead and gone. And so if he is a suspect in Wanda's case, I mean, that's just frustrating that we never really got to have those questions answered before he was gone.
Yeah, and certainly before DeLuna was put to death.
Yeah.
So now that we've talked a little bit about Carlos Hernandez's life, I mean, there's so much more we could talk about with Hernandez. Locals and people in the community believe that his mother was a bruja, a witch, and there's a whole side story about his mom's house and the crazy stuff that happened there and other members of his family and a really rough upbringing. But, you know, after just looking at his rap sheet and talking about who he is as a criminal, how do you feel about his potential in the Wanda Lopez case?
I mean, I feel like it definitely makes sense. It seems like it's in line with his pattern of what he's done in the past, for sure, especially with a knife, attacking a woman.
Yeah.
After drinking. I mean, all of those things.
And when you compare it to DeLuna, who never had a knife charge, he never had an assault with a deadly weapon charge, he never had an armed robbery charge, none of those things. He had an attempted rape charge, and that was it, and some drunken disorderly conduct. To me, he seems to fit a lot better than Carlos DeLuna. But if that doesn't convince you, we are about to go into much more convincing evidence, specifically in Wanda Lopez's case. So let's get into that right now. Do you remember the gas station manager who had to clean up all the blood at the Shamrock gas station by the name of Robert Stange?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about him, and one of the things we mentioned was his ability to recall details and how he almost had a photographic memory. Well, the Liebman investigation team years later went back and talked to Stange. They looked at some of the details that he had and memory of the crime scene and compared it to things that they were kind of bouncing off some forensic evidence specialists that they hired for their investigation. Well, Stange's memory lined up perfectly with what they were comparing it to. Stange was able to talk about details that you would only know from looking at the crime scene photos, and few had ever seen these. In fact, the crime scene photos that were taken that night and diagrams that were written up by Detective Escobedo were not even shared with the jury or DeLuna's defense team. And I'm going to be sure to share a lot of those photos and diagrams with you. I've shared some already, but I have some more that we're going to use in today's episode. Like I said, Stange's recollection of the actual crime scene was really vivid and vital to Liebman's team since he was the last person to ever see it in real life, as it was on the night of February 4th, 1983. Another reason why Stange's accounts were so vivid and important was because he cared for Wanda. Wanda was a really good friend of his and co-worker. He was the one responsible for giving her her promotion. He also wanted answers. On top of having an impeccable memory, Stange was a bit of an armchair detective like the rest of us. He liked to read crime novels and watch crime TV shows. So he was trying to use some of those skills that he had been developing to look at what happened inside the store. Stange told Liebman's team his theory of what happened that night from what he analyzed as he did the cleanup. The following is Robert Stange's summary analysis. The attacker came in, attempted to purchase the unopened pack of Winstons that was found on the counter as a ruse. We talked a little bit that there was a pack of Winstons that was loose and found on the countertop. He then leapt over the counter to get to Wanda once the money needed to change hands. Stange remembered cleaning a dark shoe scuff off of the countertop. He thought this was the mark of the attacker, leaping towards Wanda. He remembered that the trail of blood started at the gas pump machine in the back corner behind the counter. That's where Wanda must have gotten stabbed, he thought. This is likely the location where she hit the glass, probably trying to get Kevin Baker's attention in the parking lot. Years later, a leading forensic expert from the UK was asked to look at these crime scene photos by the Liebman team. He determined the gas pump console was, in fact, where Wanda pulled the knife out of her chest, and the blood began. From the area next to the gas pump console, Stange could tell that Wanda began losing lots of blood. This is where the real struggle began, he thought. One of her shoes must have come off early on. There was no blood on it. Large smear marks from Wanda's feet in her own blood marked the floor back towards the back room. It also appeared to Stange that Wanda must have grabbed everything from the countertops to help fight off her attacker or hold on for dear life. The floor behind the counter was a mixture of blood and everything that usually sat atop the counters. Stange thought the largest part of the struggle must have happened after the attacker tried to drag Wanda back to the storage room. There was a large drag mark through a heavy smear of blood, like someone who had gone limp or given up. Then the scene changed. The next set of blood stains showed signs that Wanda had somehow found a second wind, or gotten some courage to continue fighting her attacker. Cases of Coke, 2 liters, all had been toppled over in that area, and there was a lot of blood on the floor. Stange figured they spent a good amount of time during the struggle in this section of the store. Both her and the attacker were now stepping back and forth through her falling blood drops that were trickling down her left side. To Stange, it looked like she was giving her attacker all she had at that point. Clearly in the crime scene photos, you can see what Stange recalled next, one of Wanda's barefoot impressions, where she stood her ground during the fight. He remembered scrubbing it clean. To Stange, he was wiping away Wanda's last memory. Not too far away from that footprint was another one. But this one was different. It wasn't Wanda's. A shoe print that was heading back towards the direction of the front door and was clear as day to Stange. He figured this was most likely left by the killer as he left or got spooked. From Kevin Baker's accounts, we can guess this print was left as the attacker moved towards the door to meet him. We do not have any knowledge of this print ever being compared to Carlos de Luna's shoes that were logged into evidence, but it is clear from the crime scene photos that this print did not come from a slip-on loafer-type dress shoe which de Luna was wearing that night, but rather something different, something like the treads of a sneaker or a tennis shoe.
So you're telling me we have a footprint in blood at the crime scene that was clearly left by the killer.
Yes.
And it was never compared to the person that was on trial for Wanda's murder.
Yes. And also, again, note that Carlos de Luna had no blood anywhere on him. They recovered his shoes and they had no blood on them. So how do you make a shoe print with blood on it and not have any blood, microscopic blood, on your shoes later? Did he go power wash his shoes in the alley? Like, how does that even work?
I'm stunned. I mean, that's just... I can't believe that you would overlook something like that. That's so important.
Yeah, it is very important. And it seems right there that's something that would exonerate de Luna in this case.
Uh-huh.
And it seems something simple and something as a detective you should immediately note. Okay, the killer is wearing tennis shoes. They should have blood on them. Stange spent a lot of time rethinking everything he saw that night, and still can't figure out how this could have been a botched robbery, as Detective Olivia Escobedo concluded in her report. It never sat well with Stange how Detective Escobedo and a single photographer-slash-evidence technician walked all through the crime scene without much care at all. As he cleaned the floors, he could make out traces of Escobedo's high-heeled boots, drops of water from her raincoat that was dripping from the rain, and he also saw some dirty footprints made by the photographer. Yeah, and this is backed up by crime scene photos. We have photos of them just standing in the middle of blood and evidence. And in fact, they're standing on stuff that could have fingerprints on it, could have blood evidence on it. Who knows what?
Great. Another case of people just traipsing through a crime scene as if it's not important.
And I don't know how you get this far as a detective. I don't know if they just didn't care and they knew better. I honestly don't know. Not only did they do a bad job of just moving around the crime scene, but there was another problem with this being a robbery. Stange did a second recount of the inventory and money drawer the next day and discovered something was really screwed up. The total missing amount of money from the cash register was actually around $20. His supervisor had made a miscalculation, a simple clerical error. It was not the $166 that he had reported to the detective. And it certainly was not the wadded up $149 that was inside Carlos de Luna's pocket when he was arrested. So basically what he explains in this is, like, you know how somebody will just drive away and not pay for gas? Like, that happened a lot back then. Also, if you have people that are dropping off merchandise that you're going to sell, sometimes they drop off too much and you just have to pay for it and you'll make up the difference later. And your drawer can end up short that way. He discovered that some of those things had happened and that they were only missing $20, which was a normal amount to be off. And that's probably why there was money everywhere behind the counter. Because Wanda probably had it in her hand, trying to give it to the attacker. And during the attack, she just threw it.
Yeah, and that's actually backed up from the 911 call. Because if I remember correctly, she was saying something like, here, take it.
Yeah, take the money.
Probably having the money in her hand, thinking that's what he wanted and was trying to comply.
Yeah.
So whoever this person was, it sounds like money was not the first thing on their mind.
No, again, it's another point that makes us lean more towards this being a sexually driven attack or, you know, something of that nature.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely kind of makes sense because if you were walking into a gas station to rob them and the woman was handing you cash from the drawer, which it certainly sounds like that's what was happening, you just take it and run.
Right.
You're not going to jump over the counter at her. You're not going to stab her. And you're not going to then start dragging her to the back of the store if all you wanted was money.
Right. And, you know, Stange talked about that Wanda was doing everything she had been trained to do. He taught her how to deal with a robbery. And he said, you know what? You open the register, you give them whatever they want, and they leave, and it's fine.
Yeah.
You're not going to get in trouble. You know, that's what you're supposed to do.
Poor thing, too, because that's exactly what she did.
Yeah.
You know, just hearing Stange's recollection or, you know, reconstruction of the crime scene is just so harrowing, her fighting for her life.
Yeah, I know. It's terrifying. Also, Kevin Baker was watching this whole thing unfold. So he's there, too, experiencing all this, trying to figure out what to do. It's just awful. Well, overall, the cleanup that Stange did that night left a horrible taste in his mouth for years. Quote, it just seemed like really sloppy police work, Stange said to the Liebman investigation team, and they also agreed with him. In fact, Stange's analysis of what happened that night matched up perfectly with the UK forensic specialist's findings almost to a T.
Damn, Stange should have been a detective.
Yeah, Detective Stange has a good ring to it.
Yeah.
It was the opinion of one of the Corpus Christi PD's senior detectives, Paul Riviera, that the decision to put Olivia Escobedo on the case from the beginning seemed to be a mistake. She hadn't handled many big investigations, murders, robberies, or capital murder cases, not since the DA in the department found flaws in her work on the Sauceda case. So she's involved in this original Sauceda case a few years earlier. They don't get a conviction because of her shoddy police work. And then you have the senior detective going like, why are you putting her on this clearly going to be capital murder case?
Wow, and it just so happens that the perpetrator in both crimes
is the same guy.
Might be the same
Probably
person.
The same guy. How crazy is that?
I mean, it's like a story. It's
wild.
Yeah.
It's bad enough luck that you're accidentally picked up for a murder that your doppelganger made that you haven't seen since childhood, but then you end up getting the detective involved with another one of his murder cases?
How is this real? I mean, this is just crazy.
It is wild. It's bonkers, dude.
I don't know if you all know this, but Shay and I love to cook. And Green Chef makes it easy. Green Chef is a USDA-certified organic company that makes eating well easy and affordable with plans to fit every kind of lifestyle. Everything is hand-picked and delivered right to your door. Ingredients come pre-measured, perfectly portioned, and mostly prepped. Recipes are quick and easy with step-by-step instructions, chef tips, and photos to guide you along. Green Chef makes it really, really simple to make delicious and healthy meals that your family will be impressed by. And they have meal plans that fit every kind of lifestyle. They include paleo, vegan, vegetarian, pescatarian, Mediterranean, heart smart, lean and clean, keto, gluten-free, and omnivore. Shay and I chose the omnivore option, and we picked a delicious meal to try. It was the shawarma spice steak quinoa bowl. It was healthy, it was easy to make, and it made me feel like I actually know what I'm doing in the kitchen when I do not. If you'd like to try Green Chef for yourself and for $50 off your first box of Green Chef, go to greenchef.us/cattle. Again, that's $50 off your first box of Green Chef. Just go to greenchef.us/cattle.
It was Riviera's opinion that both crime scenes that Escobedo analyzed and processed had serious problems. After Riviera looked over Escobedo's reports on both the Sauceda and Wanda Lopez cases, he concluded that Hernandez got away with the first murder and had his doubts that De Luna killed Wanda Lopez. Liebman's team came to similar conclusions as well. Several elements of forensic evidence were not stored, analyzed, or investigated properly, and this goes beyond the shoe prints. I also talked about that partially smoked cigarette butt last episode. It was tested for saliva and shown to be positive. That's all that was ever done with it.
Sorry, this was a partially smoked cigarette butt that was found
in the crime scene. And it tested positive for saliva, and that's all they ever did with it.
Okay, well, they couldn't have done DNA at the time.
Sure, but they could have stored it properly so they could do DNA on it later during appeals processes. Because that does happen, and it was not stored properly.
So you're telling me that today we could have direct evidence that points to who the killer was?
Oh, yes.
Except that the evidence wasn't stored properly.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
And speaking of saliva, it gets worse. There was also a big wad of chewing gum that had been most likely spat out on the ground by the killer that had wet saliva on it. It was photographed. It wasn't bagged.
They didn't collect that?
They didn't collect it.
You are not telling me the truth.
No.
I cannot believe that they wouldn't have collected something like that.
Yeah, they didn't. And they also didn't collect a mostly empty beer can that was found behind the counter, which
what?
Was probably being drank by the killer before he started the attack and just tossed it behind the counter.
So not even that it was collected and lost. It was just not even collected.
Just left. In fact, Stange cleaned both of those things up.
I am almost speechless right now.
Yeah. But there's more. Fingernail scrapings of Carlos De Luna weren't processed either. They took fingernail scrapings, never did anything with it. Well, that's actually not true. They did do something with them. They let them sit and decay in an evidence storage locker to the point that they were no longer useful. They were not stored properly. Ultimately, they could have been used at one point before they had degraded too much, but those samples were lost before they could be analyzed for exoneration purposes during one of Carlos's appeals. He actually asked for them to look at them, but they were like, oh, sorry, lost those.
With his point being, you're not going to find anything that connects me to Wanda.
He wanted them to look at him.
Good God.
Well, you know, there was one thing at the crime scene. There was a lot of frickin' blood. You've seen the crime scene pictures.
Oh, yeah.
None of the blood inside the gas station was actually tested for separate blood types. It was assumed that all the blood was Wanda's. And if the killer had been cut or scratched during the scuffle with Wanda, he might have left some of his own blood at the scene. There's a very suspicious bloody handprint that was left on the front door where most likely the attacker opened it.
Well, why did they think that it was the killer's? I mean, it could have just been Wanda's blood that was on his hands.
It could have been, but it was never tested, I think, is the real point. Like,
yeah,
if he was cut and bleeding and leaving blood around, that would be real good evidence to use to exonerate De Luna if that's not his blood.
Wow.
Fingerprints that could have been compared to the ones on file with Carlos Hernandez's rap sheets were never thoroughly analyzed.
They weren't compared to De Luna either.
Nope.
How did they even convict De Luna when they didn't even collect any evidence?
No, they didn't collect any evidence. They didn't collect hair fibers that were found behind the counter in the victim's blood that were later shown to be two different persons' hair fibers. So Wanda's hair was in the blood, where the attacker was grabbing her by the hair, but she was also fighting him off and probably grabbed some of his hair. And that hair was in the blood. Never analyzed. It was just visually shown to be different hair.
Which obviously we've talked about hair analysis and it not being a super solid line of evidence, but it can tell you certain information. It can perhaps show that somebody might have been the person where that hair came from or that they probably weren't. When you go to any kind of crime scene, you want to test and use everything that's available to you. So
to leave it untested is mind-boggling.
To not do anything with it, is shocking.
And I think the overarching point I'm trying to make here is that any one of these things could have proved crucial during De Luna's trial or even throughout all of his appeals processes. But again and again and again, these were either kind of swept under the rug and not talked about or outright just hidden from his defense lawyers. So what happened? How did all of this get missed? What was Escobedo doing while she was in the gas station that night for a little bit over an hour? Well, Detective Escobedo later admitted to leaving her police radio on and sitting on the counter while she was processing the crime scene because she wanted to stay apprised as to how the manhunt was going. She followed along with the chatter between dispatch and the patrol units, and once DeLuna was in custody and the show-up ID positively identified him as the killer, Escobedo quickly wrapped up her investigation and walked out. It's like she was thinking all of this crime scene work was no longer necessary. They had their man, they had multiple witnesses, so she just turned the scene over to the Sigmore Shamrock employees.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely what it sounds like. Now, do we have anybody who can argue against that, though, that there was some other explanation that we're not aware of?
No, because the Corpus Christi Police Department and the Nueces County DA's office both refused to talk about this case in the media or to researchers. And we're going to get into that at the end. But first, we need to talk about those eyewitnesses. And I know you love eyewitness testimony,
Erin. Oh, it's great.
And we also got to talk about that chase through the South Corpus Christi neighborhood that eventually led to DeLuna's capture. Well, let's break that down for a second. We know what Kevin Baker saw, and I think we can all agree that he saw the killer. But what did the other witnesses say? And what did they actually see? The first witness to arrive at the scene and was told to stand next to Kevin Baker over by the ice machine while paramedics worked on Wanda was George Aguirre. George had been the concerned person that showed up to the gas station earlier and reported the man outside fiddling with a knife who looked like he was up to no good.
Oh, interesting. We haven't heard from this person.
Yeah. And he had a police radio and he heard what was going on. He was like, oh, crap, I was just there. And so he went back up there to tell police what he had seen. The man he saw was also asking for a ride to the casino club in exchange for money or drugs.
Ah, so that's where the information from the bolo came from.
Exactly. And he described a man in dirty blue jeans with a white shirt and a long sleeve flannel overshirt wearing white sneakers. He said he was older, maybe early 30s, and had some stubble on his face. So this seems to match up really well with Kevin Baker's description. And both of these people had direct contact and were mere feet away from the person who probably killed Wanda.
Yeah.
Next, Julie and John Arzuaga arrived. What these individuals saw sounded like a completely different person. They saw a well-dressed young man briskly walking and jogging eastward past the Phase 3 club as they pulled into the parking lot. The reason why they made note of this person is he was a young man, and he cut across their headlights and kind of sprinted into a field near the Leibowitz furniture store and then jumped a fence into a nearby neighborhood. They thought the man looked comical at first, like the way he was moving around. He looked sort of goofy as he did this weird speed walk, all the while looking over his shoulder like someone was after him. After they heard that there had been a stabbing, the Arzuagas decided to tell the police what they had seen. Their description is the only one that fits Carlos DeLuna. And it also matches his story of what he told police, that after he saw what was going on in the gas station, he briskly walked away in the eastward direction down the frontage road that goes right in front of this club.
Yeah, and again, it makes sense in that Be On the Lookout that they put out is why we have a combination of two descriptions. It's because it seems like people saw and were describing two different people.
Yeah. Also, radio dispatch recordings were analyzed by the Liebman team. When going through these, it showed people calling in right after the attack had happened. They were reporting another man who many people now believe was Carlos Hernandez. This man was spotted running down Dodd Street, away from the gas station and the Wolfie's Gentleman's Club. He was wearing, again, a white shirt, flannel overshirt, blue jeans, and white sneakers. This would be kind of heading in that north direction towards that neighborhood. And then soon more reports of the same man showed up with him turning east onto McArdle Road. Based on the trajectory of these reports as they came in, this was likely the man police ended up chasing through a neighborhood almost a mile from the Sigmore gas station before he ultimately got away.
Ugh.
They had him. They were so close. Like, they were physically chasing him on foot through a neighborhood. If you also plot out the two headings of these different eyewitness reports into an area map, tragically, it shows that Carlos DeLuna likely ran right into the wake of a fleeing Carlos Hernandez. He literally could have run in any other direction and probably would have been fine. Or, you know, just run back into Wolfie's bar and tell the cops what you saw. But he picked the one direction that was the worst possible option to go. Your face right now is wild.
It's just fucking nuts, dude.
Yeah. At every turn, you look at every piece of this case and it just gets wilder and Wilder. Speaking of which, there's also evidence that the police officers beat up DeLuna before bringing him back to the Sigmore gas station for the show-up ID. He had a puffy face, a busted lip, a bruised cheek, and a cut on his nose in the mugshots. DeLuna also claimed to his lawyer that the police beat him severely after they pulled him from underneath the truck where he was hiding. On the Corpus Christi police reports, and kind of the chatter that was going back and forth over the radio, there's a 40-minute gap in their timeline from when they arrested Luna and put him in the back of the patrol car and said they were headed back to the Sigmore gas station for the show-up ID. This gas station is literally right around the corner from where they found him.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, he was walking away from the scene, so it's not like it's miles and miles away.
No. So how did it take 40 minutes? It's possible that they beat him up before they took him back to the show-up ID. All of this likely didn't help the witnesses make a very good decision whether or not this was the attacker.
Yeah, just minutes and minutes ticking by.
Yeah, he has no shirt, his face is all screwed up, and he even looked different in later processing photos, and Kevin Baker started to get, like, unsure if it was the guy when he saw the second set of photos for a photo lineup. So now we need to get back into the trial, and speaking of Kevin Baker, we need to talk about his testimony and beyond. So Kevin Baker now admits he was convinced by investigators and later prosecutors that Carlos DeLuna was the killer, even though he had his doubts. Even by the time of the trial, Kevin said his confidence in the idea of DeLuna was fading. And now I'm going to play a clip from an interview with Kevin Baker by the Liebman team back in 2006.
How certain were you that night?
Probably 70%. It wasn't 50-50. It was more. But I will say this. One of the police officers did mention to me, we found this guy hiding underneath the car without a shirt on. Two blocks north of us.
If they had not said that, would you be less than 70% sure?
Yes.
About yes. Where would you say you'd be if they hadn't said that?
It would have been a 50-50.
Wow, yeah. So we can clearly see that it was what the police officer said to him that made him feel more confident about his identification. It wasn't actually seeing the person
and being
saying,
like, oh, that's the guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's, oh, well, he must be the guy because of what they just told me.
Yeah. Why would he be hiding under a car unless this is him?
Yeah. And let's be clear. Like, we're not, I'm certainly not blaming Kevin Baker.
Oh, no. He's innocent in this, I think.
Well, I would say he's almost a victim in all of
this. Yeah.
Because, you know, you're just trying to do the best you can. And he certainly didn't mean to screw anything up or make a bad call, but you get put into this position and they're telling you what you can do to help, and that's all you want to do is help. So you're like, okay, well, yeah, that's the guy. It must be the guy because you got him.
And you know, Kevin Baker tried to stop the situation. He tried to pack Wanda's wounds.
Yeah.
He ended up running the dude off, and now he's put in this terrible situation.
Jeez, man.
Kevin Baker also said the whole ordeal ended up just shattering his life.
Ugh.
Later that year in 1983, he had to go into counseling for stress to cope with the whole situation.
Oh, I'm sure.
And he and his wife soon got a divorce. He says it's related to the experience. He says also he now lives with both the ghost of Wanda Lopez as well as that of the innocent man he helped put to death, Carlos DeLuna.
So Kevin Baker is definitely on the side that DeLuna was not the man who killed Wanda.
He feels like mistakes were made. And that the whole case should not have been pinned on witness identification. Because he's been shown all the stuff that has been found in this case, and he feels terrible about it.
Yeah.
We talked a little bit about how the prosecution withheld the crime scene photos from the defense. But we never got an answer as to why. And it now appears that the Nueces County DA's office kept a lot more from DeLuna's attorneys. Like the other evidence that was never processed. Things of that nature. Well, remember when I told you that the lead prosecutor made fun of DeLuna's claim that another Carlos committed the crime and that this was simply not true and he couldn't exist? His direct quote from trial testimony was, quote, Hernandez is a phantom. He doesn't exist. We know now that the lead prosecutor checked out Carlos Hernandez's actual rap sheet from the records department in Corpus Christi Police Department. He did that before the trial started. We know this for a fact because he signed and dated a form to check it out. This was a day after DeLuna's defense attorneys asked for the original date of his trial to be postponed to search for Carlos Hernandez. Remember how DeLuna's defense team, the onus was on them to find Carlos Hernandez and that they had limited resources? You know, they're assigned defense attorneys from the state. They don't make a lot of money. They had limited resources, and they really couldn't find this Carlos Hernandez anywhere they looked. They believed he existed, but they just couldn't find him. Well, it's really interesting because a few weeks after DeLuna was charged for the crime, Corpus Christi Police Department picked up Hernandez and brought him in for questioning. They took fingerprints, and they took a statement as to where he was that night, but they later released him. DeLuna actually sat in a holding cell just a few doors down from Hernandez, in the same police station. They could have spoke to each other, through the bars. Who knows? The mugshots that I'm going to post of the two Carloses so you can see what they look like, and compare them, and judge for yourself how easy it is to confuse them, were taken weeks apart from each other in the same photo booth.
What?
Yeah. The Corpus Christi Police Department actually knew Hernandez pretty well. They certainly knew of his existence from the Sauceda case a few years earlier. So basically, they were withholding evidence from the defense team.
Okay, so why wasn't any of this used in appeals?
It wasn't discovered until around 2006 when Liebman's team did their investigation.
So you're saying we have clear evidence that while the defense team was busting their ass trying to find Carlos Hernandez, the prosecution knew well who he was.
Yep, they didn't move a finger.
I don't even know what to say to any of this.
I don't either.
This is horrific. And this should be, just like Justice Scalia said, this should be something that people are outraged by. We should have answers to all of this.
Yeah, we should. I also think that the people that were involved in this case, prosecutors, investigators, judges, DAs, all have to answer for these things too, and they should speak out and clear the record. But it's going to be hard because a lot of these people still work in those systems. Some of them have become judges. Some of them are elected officials. You really think they're going to pull out one of their dustiest skeletons from the closet and, you know, wave it around for everybody to see and then not get reelected? Another troubling detail about Carlos Hernandez uncovered by the Liebman team was that he was working as a police informant well into 1983. They were using Hernandez's testimony on lots of cases. He was an insider into the underbelly of Corpus Christi, and he was a rat. Corpus Christi defense attorney John Kelly, who represented Hernandez several times, said, quote, "We were all familiar with him. If I needed information on the community, Hernandez could get it." This was corroborated by longtime Corpus Christi cop Eddie Garza, who spoke about the nature of the city's relationship with Hernandez. Based on what his informants told him, as well as the facts of the case, Eddie Garza believes Carlos Hernandez was a very strong suspect for the murder of Wanda Lopez. Now, beyond the evidence that could have exonerated DeLuna, everything that was withheld from his defense team, and all the sloppy police work, there is another troubling fact to this case. Numerous reports of bragging and omissions of guilt by Carlos Hernandez himself flooded into the Corpus Christi Police Department only weeks after DeLuna's arrest. Dina Ibanez, one of Hernandez's last victims who we talked about earlier, was one of these people. She claimed Hernandez once bragged openly to her regarding the murder of Wanda Lopez. She said he also talked about women who had been raped at knife point, other cases, in fact, other women that Carlos was a suspect for, who he was never charged with. He used these attacks at knife point typically to rape and to get what he wanted. These were intimidation attacks. I personally think Hernandez was attacking Wanda and dragging her to the back room to rape her at knife point. And Dina talks about how he was usually stabbed first, rape later. Two other relatives, Priscilla Jaramillo and her cousin, both spoke out several times about overheard conversations between Carlos Hernandez and their uncle. The two men were discussing how Carlos had hurt a woman named Wanda Lopez at a gas station, and he had gotten away with it. Hernandez also bragged that his tocayo, DeLuna, was taking the fall for the murder, and that he was happy about it and getting away scot-free. Dina, Priscilla, and so many others called or showed up at the station with reports of Hernandez's outlandish bragging that he had killed Wanda Lopez. Dozens of Hernandez's neighbors, family, co-workers, they all told detectives the same stories, that the real killer was running around Corpus Christi boasting that he had gotten away with. For reasons only known to the Corpus Christi Police Department and the Nueces County DA's office, these reports were never looked into, no further interviews were conducted, not a single person came to interview Dina, Priscilla, or her cousin until the Liebman investigation team showed up in 2006. Why not? Was the forensic evidence leading to Carlos Hernandez too problematic because it wasn't done correctly? Was it just that there was a stronger case to convict DeLuna, seemingly on eyewitness testimony, and they thought they had him dead to rights on that. And they didn't even want to open up this rotting, festering other case that they had that was not a slam dunk. Was that it? The question still remains, how could this mountain of evidence for someone who clearly fit the crime was there for the taking, and nothing was done with it? Were the Nueces County DA's office covering previous mistakes in cases like the Sauceda murder? Did they realize they made a real blunder putting a bad detective on the case from the beginning and tried to ignore it? Was the spotlight of a capital murder case burning too bright to allow any bad evidence to enter the equation? We've talked about this before. Death penalty cases get really hot. And if you're a lead prosecutor on a capital murder case, you pull no punches. Like, this is your career on the line.
Yeah.
And you have to get a conviction.
Yeah.
They will resort to dirty tactics, and that looks like exactly what they did in this case. Had they mistakenly hedged all their bets on that eyewitness testimony that seemed so good at the time? And when there were clear signs that their suspect might be innocent, they forged ahead anyway. Was it simply due to hubris? I don't know. But even though the Nueces County DA's office and the Corpus Christi Police Department don't want to talk about this case, there's still people like James Liebman and investigators who are now dragging these details out into the light for all to see. Now, DeLuna's sister, Rose, also spoke in several of these documentaries and in the book, and she always knew that her brother was innocent of these crimes. She never wavered. A lot of their family supported him until he was executed. They really wanted to help him, but a lot of it was they didn't know how. They didn't know the legal system. They didn't have money. They couldn't hire really good lawyers to help him. The whole ordeal has riddled their family with grief, remorse, and sorrow. They always believed Carlos was innocent. Prison chaplain Carol Pickett, who was in the death chamber holding Carlos de Luna's hand the day he was put to death, had much to say about the man in an interview with ABC News. He always felt de Luna was innocent and that he was a good man on the inside. They used to do a lot of Bible study together. De Luna always told him he was innocent of his charges. After de Luna was finally put to death, Pickett had this to say, quote, "I've seen the details of this case. I've looked at it. You need to look at the whole picture. What is this accomplishing?" Meaning the death penalty. "It's not deterring crime. It's only causing situations of doubt and injustice to be possible," end quote. And that's from a dude who's in the death chamber all the time. There's many opponents out there of James Liebman. And, you know, James Liebman is a professor who, from the beginning, has set out on this experiment to see if they could find someone who was innocent who was put to death by capital punishment. Not everybody supports what he's doing. And a lot of people claim that he's a left-wing anti-death penalty advocate who has skewed the facts of this case to his own hypothesis. But I've looked into some of those claims. Those people don't point to anything specific. Most legal experts from both sides of the political spectrum back Liebman and his team's findings. Many of them push for reform with regards to the death penalty based on this document that was published in the Columbia Law Review. Again, this document has been looked at by scholars and peers and the legal system and the scholarly community. It's been peer-reviewed. This is the biggest publication from this law review ever to be put out. They back it. I want to leave it up to our listeners to go read Liebman's report for themselves. It's big and daunting and it's thick, but there's some really amazing information in there. And so you'll learn so much about everyone involved in this case. There's a whole section on Carlos de Luna's background that's fascinating. I recommend it, and you should go read it and make your own decisions. And I think if you do, you'll end up in the same boat that Aaron and I are in today, where mainly it just looks like we put an innocent man to death, and that's the important part.
So the people who argue against what Liebman was saying about Carlos de Luna's innocence, what kind of arguments do they have against his evidence?
They don't really ever point to anything specific. It just seems to be politically motivated or that they're just supporters of the death penalty. And they don't like him attacking that.
Okay. Well, I mean, I do understand what they're saying in that he was searching for a case of a man who was put to death and who was innocent. And then he found one, and that, you know, maybe some people could claim that he created one. But ultimately, you need to be arguing against his evidence, not against the man.
Yeah.
And
or the ideals.
So you know, it's really interesting to me that there are people, A, who are upset by this, because I think no matter what you believe in, you should be upset if somebody was innocent and put to death.
Could any of us imagine being in Kevin Baker or Carlos de Luna's shoes?
Sure. but also that it doesn't seem like there are legitimate complaints about the evidence that Liebman has put forth. It really does seem like what he and his team have stated in their book is legitimate evidence.
Yeah. It was like peeling back an onion. Like every time you'd pull a layer off, there was just another one. And it was just as scary as the last one that you went through. And every time I thought that I had like the hook in the case and I was like, oh, well, clearly this is what's wrong. Then I'd find something completely different. And I'm like, well, oh gosh, how am I going to put this all together?
Yeah.
And that's how this became a 2-part series. But I think it's good that we did it because, man, was it fascinating and horrifying at the same time. You know, lastly, was Carlos Hernandez a serial killer? He appears to definitely be a serial rapist.
Well, it looks like he's a pretty good suspect in the murder of Wanda. He looked like a pretty good suspect in the murder of Dahlia. And we know that he attacked, for sure, Dina because he was convicted for that.
Yep.
So, I mean, that's 2 murders, perhaps a 3rd attempted murder right there. If he, you know, allegedly, obviously. So, I mean, right there, you've got enough evidence to point that way. And who knows if there are other women out there. I mean, you mentioned that there were other sexual assaults. So are there other murders that could be connected to Carlos Hernandez?
Yeah, it's a fascinating question. And they were all sexually driven. That's
yeah.
Another thing.
As all serial murder is.
Yeah, but that's all I got for you guys.
I still feel very taken aback and stunned and shocked. I feel like my mouth has just been on the floor this entire episode.
Yeah, I keep looking over there and your eyes are wide and your mouth is agape. And I keep waiting for you to say something and you're just staring at me. It was shocking.
It's just nuts. I feel like I'm going to need days to process everything that you just told me. It sounds like one of the most horrible miscarriages of justice that I've ever heard of. And so I feel really compelled to go out and read this book and look at all this information because, my God, if this is true, and you've definitely presented Liebman's argument very well, where it's really hard to see anything but that a innocent man was put to death.
Yeah. Again, we want to also hear from you guys on social media. Get at us about what you think about this case. And also, we need to thank Drew Margerison for selecting this topic as a Texas Ranger. Drew freaking rocks. We love you, Drew. Thank you so much for your support and being a producer for this series. And with that, I think I'm ready for some good news. I'm definitely ready to close that book and not open it for a while.
All right, well, let's move on to good news right after this.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, it is Ryan. And we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Well, guys, I know that we're all fuming and in a rage right now, but I have a really good news story today coming from right here in Fort Worth, Texas. This is from CBS DFW 21. Back in September of last year, 63-year-old Bruce Richards was at work at a place called ID Technologies, which is a company that makes labeling, coding, and marking equipment and products. It was a normal day until Bruce suddenly began having a major heart attack and collapsed. But thankfully, Bruce's friend and coworker of 20 years, Dave France, was there to save the day. France immediately recalled an old CPR class he had taken years before, and after having another coworker called 911 and grabbing an AED, an automated external defibrillator, he set to work to save Bruce's life. An AED is a medical device that you can find in a lot of public places. You've probably seen them around your office, for example.
Oh, yeah. I have them at work.
Yeah. It analyzes the heart's rhythm and, if necessary, produces an electrical shock or defibrillation to help the heart get back to a normal rhythm. The AED ended up shocking Bruce twice by the time the emergency responders arrived to rush him to Medical City North Hills. Bruce went into cardiac arrest 4 times on the way to the hospital, and as soon as he arrived, he was rushed into the operating room to get open heart surgery and a stent placed. So wow. This was a very, very serious situation.
It sounds like it.
Thankfully, Bruce fully recovered and was back at work within a couple of months, and he credits Dave with saving his life through his quick thinking and action. Quote, Dave France saved my life, along with the first responders who came to our office and the people at Medical City North Hills. There's no doubt about that. And if the AED had not been in our office, I wouldn't have made it. If every little thing had not fallen together exactly as it did, I would not be here. So I'm living on bonus time.
Yeah, Dave France gave him a chance.
That's right. Well, for his role in helping to save Bruce's life, Dave was just recently given a Lifesaver Award by Medical City North Hills. Bruce just celebrated his 64th birthday this past week on April 9th, and many of their fellow coworkers at ID Technologies have been inspired to also take CPR classes and AED training.
Yeah, I don't have any of those. I feel like I need to get some.
Yeah, and it's really important. Personally, I would love to take another CPR class. And if your job offers that training, definitely take them up on it. Because according to the Red Cross, an average response time for an ambulance is between 8 to 12 minutes.
Wow.
And for every minute a person goes without defibrillation, if they're in cardiac arrest, the odds of survival decline by about 10%.
Ooh, that's pretty bad.
Yeah, so it's super important to know that kind of basic safety training and to be prepared because you never know when you'll need it. And we all have that equipment around our offices, but a lot of us haven't really been trained to know how to use it. I know it's supposed to be a very, like the AED, basically it'll speak to you. It'll tell you exactly what to do. So it's a very user-friendly, it's built for a layperson to use it. You don't want to be using it for the first time in that kind of situation.
No.
So it's important to have that training. I thought this was a really cool story, and I really liked how he inspired his coworkers to also get this training. Because more people need it. It's really important.
It's one of those things where you never think about it until it's too late.
Yeah. And I also learned something because I was doing a little research on the AED. And the portable AED was invented in Ireland by an Irish inventor.
Oh, all right.
So thank you, that guy. I didn't write his name down, but I thought that was interesting. Yeah. So thank you, the Irish. Because basically the Irish saved this guy's life.
Yeah, that's my people. That's my homeland.
Yeah.
Thank you, fellow Irishman.
And now it's time for our podcast recommendation of the week. And this week it is a podcast that you should be listening to if you aren't already. What are you doing here?
Yeah, I guess that not everyone's heard about it, but it's a huge one.
Yeah, and it is The Minds of Madness. And like we said, this is a really popular podcast, as well it should be. It's excellently produced, written, hosted. It's pretty much one of the best, I think, podcasts out there. In
yeah.
True crime. It's hosted by Tyler, and Beck is the producer, I think, slash researcher. They're a team that just covers the most interesting cases. They cover them sensitively. They do a lot of audio and interviews with victims and families, and just an excellent podcast. They've won a ton of awards.
Yeah.
And like I said, it's not shocking. If you've listened to an episode of their show, you're like, oh, well, of course, because they're fantastic.
Yeah, husband and wife team, like us, so salute.
Yep.
Also Canadian, right?
Yeah, they are Canadian.
Yeah.
They are, yeah.
Hello, Canadian friends.
Yeah. So anyways, if this is our shout out to them, we really love them. We really respect them as a podcast. And here is their promo right here.
911, what's your emergency?
Every 60 seconds. A person is murdered somewhere in the world.
There was a shootout in my house. I can't believe it.
What causes ordinary people to do unthinkable things?
He stabbed me in my neck. And he says, look how easily I could kill you.
The Minds of Madness is a true crime podcast that examines the most disturbing criminal minds. We shed a light on the devastating impact these violent crimes have on the victims and their families.
When you get calls in the night, you know they're not good or they're wrong numbers.
You'll hear about the incredible strength of the survivors and what they did to fight back.
I was studying his face because I was thinking, if I get out of this, I'm going to get you someday.
Subscribe to the Minds of Madness podcast today on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and Google Play.
All right, guys, it's back to the after show.
The after show, episode 50.
Oh my gosh. Congratulations on 50 episodes, Shay.
Yeah, congratulations. We're rapidly approaching 1 million downloads. We hit 50 episodes. I never thought we would be at this point. This started out as a weird little hobby and turned into like a quasi-professional thing. It still feels weird.
Yeah, you know, I feel like we've grown a lot. We've gotten better. So that's good.
Hey, you know, most people don't make it past 7 episodes. So here's to the next 50. Here's to 100 episodes, Aaron.
Oh, good God. I might die before then.
You've done so much work on the first 50.
God, I don't want to do another 50. It's too much.
Oh, you guys come research episodes for us. We've done enough.
Oh, okay. Well, why are we here? What are we doing?
Oh,
shout outs for patrons.
Yeah, shout outs for patrons. That's what we're doing. All the people that support us and make it possible for us to do the show. We really appreciate you guys. If you would like to become a patron of the show, you can always go to patreon.com/allcrimenocattle. We have a lot of really interesting rewards there and ways to support the show from anywhere from $1 all the way up to $20. And this week, as always, we have to give shout outs to our wonderful Texas Rangers. Those are Lisa L., the Serial Killer Sweets, Michelle Guess, Drew Margerison, who produced this episode, Kate Williams, Mel Thomas, and Don Maloney. Thank you guys. You guys are awesome. You rock. Thanks for producing the show. And next, we got to do the Lone Guns. And this is the $5 tier. This is your week. So, hey, Karen Alden, Jenny Cargill, Claire Jeans from Australia, Connie Gibson, Kara Jarvis, Mickey N., Lindsay Wiggins, Christina Snyder, Uber Chick Polish, Allison Moon, Patricia Wilson, Lauren Miller, Daya Kendra Hopsari Subagayo, nailed it, Megan Jirai, The Dark Poutine Podcast, Mary Alice Coffiero, Amy Derrick, Gerilyn Carmichael, Amy McMahon, Stacey Wolf Wegleitner, Marshall Bingham, Coral Baish, Jeremy Thomas, Amanda Newman, Alice Lynch, Emily Hesch, Ann Nunnally, Sam Marshall, The Gone Cold Podcast, Karen Burrows, Mariel Eckholm, Laura, Emily Blassengame, Pam Sullivan, and Pam...
Did you say Pan? Is it Pan?
Is there an N in it? Are you saying Pan? No, it's Pam Sullivan. Thank you, Lone Guns. We really appreciate it. You guys rock.
And Pam, if you're wondering, that was a stepbrother's joke.
That's right. Great movie.
We're here all week.
It's our Pan routine. But that's all. That's all we got. Now we're off to record a couple of commercials, watch some Stars hockey because we're in the playoffs. Go Stars. We won the first game earlier this week.
And finish our rewatch of Game of Thrones season 8.
Yeah, we're getting caught up on that because we're going to a watching party this weekend for the first episode of season 8.
I'm so nervous.
Yeah.
Oh, it's going to be exciting.
Shout out to all of our true crime fans who are also Game of Thrones fans and fans of Song of Ice and Fire.
That's right. Well, guys, remember, you can always find us on our social media. We're at All Crime No Cattle on Instagram. We are at ACNC Podcast on Twitter. Email is allcrimenocattle@gmail.com. And what else do we got? Oh, our discussion group on Facebook. Brand new. We just hit over 400 members.
Yeah.
And let's see. It is ACNC Discussion. No, ACNC Posse Discussion Group.
That is
correct. Because we had to make it complicated, of course. So find us there. We have a fun time in that place. It's nice.
Also, you can call and leave us a voicemail if you call 682-200-9972. We also accept jokes. Cool comments, lots of praise. That's great.
Lots of praise.
Yeah.
Especially that last one.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Well, thank you. We will see you back here next week. And it'll be great.
Yeah, it'll especially be great because I've done 3 episodes in a row, and it's not my week anymore. It's your turn, Aaron. I pass the ball to you.
I drop it.
Oh, all right, guys. Well, until then, always remember that crime is bigger in Texas, y'all. Adios.
Bye.